Mr. David Butler, Real 9. Now, we're talking about your time with HMS Terror, which is out in the Far East.
Singapore.
In Singapore, yeah. What else was happening there? I mean, you've told some stories. I understand one of the story about HMS Newcastle you just told is a bit out of sequence because you have an injury first. Should we go step back to that?
Yeah, well, it was just I got out there in October and I used to mess around in the pool and I was playing water polo one day, just knocking around, and this ball came across and I leapt up in the air to catch it, and as I come down, I landed, I was in a shallow end, and let my knees give, but what I didn't realise is that I'd given that much that my left knee hit a piece of tile that was missing and it cut it right the way across, and my leg just floated to the top of the swimming pool. And there was wives in that, some of the wives that was in there, that was living out there at the time, said, good God, and they called the lifeguard who got me out. And then, and he phoned up the sick bay, and they took me to BMH Hospital in Singapore, where they operated on my knee. And I can't remember how long I spent in there, about a fortnight, I think, but I know I spent my 21st birthday in there. But I've got to say, I didn't get on well with the army people who run the hospital because they wanted to carry out their traditions. But the nursing sister in charge of our ward, I think I can say that she was magnificent, because it was her that made me walk properly, start walking again properly. Because when I got up and about, all I was doing was dragging my leg, because there was no physio there, or if they had been there, they didn't come and teach me how to walk, but she did. She said, you're never going to walk if you walk like that. And she made me do heel and toe. I'll never forget her. Can't think of her name, mind you, but loved her money. But she was very strict, but very good nurse. And she had me walking up and down the ward, heel and toe, heel and toe. And that's how I got back to walking properly again. But the army added this thing that when them people have inspections, they have to have their lockers open, whereas in the Navy we don't. And I wouldn't open mine for these. I suppose I was a bit bolshy, but I wouldn't open mine for these army people to look into. It was all nice and tidy, but I'm buggered if I was going to open it up for them. And I got away with it in the end. But it caused quite a stir. And that's when I had to go to the RSM of the hospital, and he put me on dustbin duties. And then when I got down there, I was supposed to empty dustbins and bins and all that jazz as part of me rehabilitation. But the corporal in charge, he said, there's no way this man can do it. He said he's not able to empty dustbins. So they just sent me back to the ward again. And then when I got back into Terror, just after that, my wife came out with our eldest son, Adrian. And we lived in Johor Bahru. And in between
now,
them,
what sort of was it? Sort of married accommodation, or what were you living in?
In a private house in Johor Bahru. There was married quarters there, but you had to wait your turn. And there was quite a few people. Some went in the married quarters, and others just preferred to stay out. I think you got a little bit more money by staying out, actually. But we spent all our time in Johor Bahru, living in Johor Bahru. Although we changed addresses about three times, I think, for better houses. But it was very good. I had my eldest daughter was born there, who I went down and saw last night. She in 1957, she was born there. And one of the things we didn't realise is that we should have registered her in England when we got back from the Far East. But nobody in them days told you things like this. And of course, when the first census came up, she was classed as an alien. So this was, we're talking in the 60s, I think it was. She was classed as an alien. And we went absolutely ape over it. Because, you know, it would to us, I've jumped the gun a bit here, but it seemed a bit unfair that she was born in a British hospital in Singapore and she got a birth certificate, but it was a Singapore one, unfortunately. But that's how it goes. But she's still alive and kicking today.
Now, anything else happened while you were with Terror, HMS Terror?
Done a lot of sport. I've done a large amount of sport. We also, I also, because I worked down in by the reserve fleet, we had a diver come in one day, a Japanese diver, who had got the bends. And HMS Terror had got a diving bell, where resuscitation chamber, they call them. They'd got one of them. And they asked me if I would stay there over the weekend to run the diving bell with the diving officer and two divers that were part of HMS Terror Ship Company. And I would run look after the machinery for the diving bell. And I said, yeah. And we stayed down. We brought him back up to the surface, as you might say. And I can't think. I think he was 300 foot or something when he got the bends. And so we had to resurface him. And then we had to go to the Suez Canal. Can I have that bit of paper a minute?
Now, who had to go? Because you were on a shore base, though.
Yeah, well, what had happened is that the Israelis had had the Six-Day War up in Egypt in the Suez Canal area, and they'd sank some ships in the canal. So the Admiralty sent out orders that so many people had to take a ship called Barfoyle, which was a boom lifting defence ship. It's a very small ship with two big forks on the front for lifting boys and laying boys, I suppose. This was all being organised in October and early November. And
which year?
In 58. No, 56, I'm telling a lie. In 56. We all got told who had been picked from HMS Terror, and it was all the ship's company, mostly the reserve fleet.
Now, I've got a problem there, because I thought you went out to Terror in November 56.
No, I went in November 55
right.
to Terror.
Okay.
And my wife hadn't long been out there, and there wasn't many chaps who went to, who was in the ship's company in the reserve fleet, did not go. Some of them didn't go. But it was mainly the ship's company of the reserve fleet. And it was all ships, all HMS Terror ship's company anyway. And we sailed from HMS Terror in November, early November, about the 10th. Looking at my paperwork here, we sailed and we got towed from Singapore, because it was a coal burning ship. We got towed from Singapore to Colombo in Ceylon, where we was cast off, and we sailed into harbour. We coaled ship, stored ship, and I think we spent about 3 or 4 days there. And then we set sail. We got towed again. We got towed again. I tell a lie. We got towed again. Halfway across the Indian Ocean. And we got a German ship, I think it was. And they let us go. And then we was on our own. And we had to sail into Aden. We had to get to Aden. And I can't remember the captain's name on the... he was a lieutenant commander anyway. And in all honesty, he was absolutely bloody useless as a captain. And we sailed, but we got lost. And eventually, we run out of coal. So... obviously, we should have been in Aden at a set time, so when we never arrived, they gave us, I presume, a couple of 3 days, I don't know. But then they alerted all shipping to look out for us. And apparently, it was off the shipping lines, but eventually, a Greek, I'm sure it was a Greek ship, spotted us, and they sent a message back to Aden, or wherever. And the next thing we know is that there's a seaplane coming out and looking at us and hovering over us and doing the Morse code with the lamp. and we had got a forward awning up as a sail. And he gave us directions to Aden, and we sailed into Aden with the forward awning up. And then we cold ship again in Aden, but then we were relieved.
Now, can you describe a bit more what Barfoyle was like? What was she like?
It was a grotty little ship, and the Indians had been living on it in Singapore and working on it in Singapore, and we used to lay in bed at night, or sometimes if you'd come off watching in the morning and you'd had a rough night, you used to lay in your bed in the afternoon, and you could see the rats going along the girders, and eventually we used to get sixpence a tail if we caught these rats, and then whip the tail off and throw them over the side.
What was she for? Was she a lifting ship?
She was a lifting ship. She used to lay and lift buoys in the river works or the roads, whatever you want to call them, harbours, if they was required to link. And so this was her duties. She had enough deck space up forward, say, for half a dozen buoys. And then obviously the Navy or the harbour master or whoever used to go and tell them where to lay. And they could then slide it down into the water, and then the two arms would be used to place her in the right position. And she was going to be used to lift up the smaller ships in the Suez Canal. But as I said, we only took it to Aden. But the one thing I do remember is that we had plenty of corned beef on board. And we had a three-badge leading chef called Brown, Buster Brown. And he was a really good chef. But he cooked corned beef all and every which way. We had it Christmas Day, I remember, never forget this Christmas Day, because we had corned beef for breakfast. Fritters, I think it was. We had corned beef hash for Christmas Day lunch. Don't think we had any potatoes. And we had someone else corned beef for the evening meal. But I've never seen so many meals conjured up with corned beef. And that was basically what we lived on from not long after we'd been dropped by the German in the middle of the Indian Ocean until we got to Aden. And it was lovely to have a thing. And the one thing I always remember about Aden was it was the first time I'd heard and sang rock and roll. We went and see Bill Haley and his Comets at the Astra Theatre in the RAF camp there. And then we left there and we got to Aden and we paid off there at the end of January.
So it's just a quick 2.5 months or month and a half. Couple of months on board.
2 months on board, yeah, getting to Aden, and we thought we was going to have to go up the canal actually, but I think the wives had a lot to do with it back in Terra, because they kept badgering the captain about what was happening to us and where we was going and how long would we be, because you can understand it. They was out there, and in theory, they had no money. We had to make an allotment to them so that they could go to the pay office and draw an X amount of money to live on. So they was quite perturbed about it. They was, and quite rightly so, because they'd all got families out there. And like my wife, she hadn't been out there very long, about 6 months, I think, when I was up and away and gone.
No, so you were in Aden. How did you get back to...
Now, that's a question I don't know whether I can answer. I can't remember whether we flew back. We had to fly back. But I'm damned if I know how we done it. Whether we come by RAF. We must have come by RAF plane.
Doesn't matter. Now, so when you got back, you were back on the same job?
We're back exactly the same job, and I think we had some leave, about a fortnight's leave, I think. And I'm almost certain we all went back to the same job, because when I got back we'd got a new chief PTI come out to us, Sam Johnson. And he was he'd represented England in the Olympics at the hammer throwing. And I'd been back, and I was I was quite a keen footballer, and I used to play for the first team. And I'd had to charge for the combined services out there. And he's called me into the office one day, and he says, "What are you going to do when you finish playing football?" And I said, "Well, nothing really, Chief." I said, "I suppose I should just sit. Why don't you take up referee?" And he said, "I noticed you out there sometimes, that you're referee a game in the evenings, before you go home or something like that, or if your wife's coming to terror." He said, "I've noticed you out there. You're referee a game." He said, "Why don't you take it up?" So he talked me into it, and I took up refereeing out there. And then eventually I finished up a first-class referee in the Hampshire League when I came back into England. And then I went up to the Isthmian League in London. But I had a problem with being in the Navy. Every time I went away, I used to have to come back and be regraded again. I used to have to do a month in Hampshire and being looked at all the time. And then if I was back to normal, I was put back up in the Isthmian League. But having said that, I've also refereed all around the world, so I suppose I could be called a FIFA ref.
Now, what happens next then? Anything else to tell?
No, not really. We just we had our daughter was born in 57, I lost my good conduct badge.
Now, tell me about that.
That's we had a fleet regatta in the British ships, the Australians and the New Zealanders and that. And I was my duty this one night. I was patrol, canteen patrol. There was a leading hand and three or four of us. And anyway, the Aussies had come down and the New Zealanders, and they didn't get on all that well. And some of the British lads. Once again, HMS Newcastle was there, and because air canteen in HMS Tower was bigger than the one in the dockyard. Although there was a village outside the pub, some of them used to come up for the cheap drinks in the canteens, you see. And towards closing time, there was a bit of a trouble blowing up, so the leading hand had called the PO of the day down, and he said, "Okay, righto, shut the canteen." He said, "We'll shut the canteen and we'll start getting these lads out." Well, these Aussies were being very, very stroppy and very awkward. And so they wasn't going to walk back to the dockyard. It was too far, they said, and thing. So I got on the phone, although I don't think I should have done, but I got on the phone to the dockyard in transport. I said, "Can you send a bus up to Terra County?" And I said, "We've got some Australians here." I said, "They just don't want to walk back," I said, and I've been very awkward. And we had a big chat about it. And I said, "Okay, we'll send one up." I said, "Okay, how long would it be?" I said, "About 10 minutes. And then the officer of the watch came down, who was the duty officer. And he was a lieutenant commander, electrician, I think. And he... "What's all this about?" "No, come on then." And he started getting them off. He said, "Come on, Emmy Butler, get these lads up the road with the two of you." And he told us, he said, "The lead man, tell them three there to start moving these blokes up the road." I said, "There's a bus coming, sir." I said, "That's going to take them back to the dockyard." I said, "I've had a word with the dockyard and they're going to send a bus up." I said, "As a matter of fact, it's just coming up the road now." "They're not having a bus," he said. "They're walking back." And I said, "No, sir." I said, "I've organised it for them." I said, "Let's keep the peace." I said, "We've got them in a good mood at the moment. So let's get them on the bus and back out the dockyard, out of our..." "Not in HMS Tower," he said. "They can get on the dockyard. The dockyard bus can wait outside the gate for them." And I said, "Okay." So we started, and it was a bit awkward. It was very awkward with these Australians because they weren't very up at all. And then eventually we did manage to get them out the gate, and they did have to walk back to the dockyard because the bus driver wouldn't wait. And so when we got out there, the commander said, "I want to see you, Butler," he said. So when he said, "What's all this about, Trent?" I said, we was having trouble, sir. I said, "They would not clear the canteen." So I said, I got on the phone to the dockyard transport people. I said, "It was only a matter of a bus. And could they have a bus?" And I said, after about 5 minutes, the dockyard said, "Yes, I'd send one up, as you well know." And he said, well, I don't believe in doing things for other people. I said, no, that's your trouble. I said, you think you're above other people. And he reported me, put me in the cell for the night. And then I had to see the captain eventually, and he took me good conduct badge off me for a year. I don't think I lost anything. I think I might have lost a shilling a day or something like that. I don't know.
Anything else happened before we there?
Only the Man United air crash, the Munich air crash, that happened. I can remember that happened. I can remember standing inside the dockyard gate after I'd got off the bus from Johor, and I was going to work that morning, and I was reading the Straits Times, and it was all over the paper about the Munich air crash. I can remember that vividly.
Why did it impact on you such a lot?
Because I think it was a good English football team that had been decimated in such a tragic and asinine way. Because they know now, it's all right in hindsight, but they know now that they should never try to take off. But there again, it's everything's like else, it's like insight.
So what happens next then? What's your next posting? You're on Terra till what, March 58th?
Yeah.
It's quite a long time.
Yeah. Well, we got lost, you see. That's another part of the HMS Terra saga, is that I should have been in the fleet support group, apparently, in HMS Terra, and that meant working in the dockyard. But they had been packed up. They had packed up by mid 57, I think it was. No, before that, early 57, they'd packed up and been sent home. And I, not knowingly, should have gone with them. But because I'd never worked down there, and nobody had ever sent me to work for them, I didn't work for them. Although I knew all the lads, because they lived in HMS Terra. They lived in the next mess to us. And I used to play football with some of them. And then also, we'd done a census. I think they'd done a census at the end of 57 or the beginning of 58. And the Royal Navy sent a signal out, what's Emmy Butler doing out in HMS Terra? He should be home in England. And when they sent for me, I said, well, I don't know. I didn't know I was working for them. And somebody made a cock-up in the draft in the regulating office in HMS Terra. And they sent me down the reserve fleet when I should have been working in the dockyard. And I suppose that's one of the steps that changed my life completely. And then when we flew home...
Remember anything about the flight? Or?
Very bumpy. It was very bumpy. And when we flew into Turkey, Ankara, you had to go between two cliffs. And for love nor money, I never thought the plane was going to clear them cliffs. By God, it was so, we looked so close to them cliffs, and that nerved me. And then when we got into England, that unnerved me a bit, that did. But when we got into England, we had no accommodation for us, and we're talking in the middle of the night, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. Oh yes, we had to touch down at Rome. We had to touch down at Rome, or was it Brindisi? Brindisi. We touched down at Brindisi because of fog in London. And we landed at this airport, and patrolling the airport were people with rifles and machine guns. And I thought, it sounded a throwback from war, but it was just something. We were all amazed about this. And then we went to they led us to go to Paris, and we had to stop in Paris for about 3 hours, which meant we landed in London. Had to be 1 o'clock in the morning. Stansted, I believe it was. And we got there, and I said, can we have some accommodation for my wife, family and me? And I said, no, we haven't got any. I said, well, you've got to have. I said, we can't get anywhere, and I'm not going to sit in the airport. And eventually, they got us a bed and breakfast. And when we got there, it was run by the army. I didn't realise they'd done this type of thing, but they must do, a halfway house type of thing. But it was run by the army. And this young soldier that was in there, he hadn't got a clue. He couldn't make us a cup of tea because he had no stores or anything. And they gave us they put us in this room. And he said, oh, you'll need money for the meter, which was, I think, a shilling a go then. I said, well, have you got any change, mate? And, you know, I said, we got no English money. I said, we've got to wait until the morning before we can change our Singapore money. No, he said, I haven't. So we went knocking on doors and where there's a light shining on the door. We knocked the door. And eventually we got three shillings off different people. They lent us some money for the thing to keep the kids warm. Then we had to get extra blankets because we'd only got one blanket for one bed. Because it was a double bed, but we got two kids and me and the missus. So we never slept that night. We managed to get a cup of tea eventually. And then we caught the train home in the morning to Leamington Spa. And went to live with mother-in-law.
Now, just one point, I didn't correct you at the time. When you said the Six-Day War, you didn't mean the Six-Day War, you meant the Suez Crisis.
The Suez Crisis.
Yeah, not the Six-Day Wars. Not the
Six-Day Wars when I was on Arethusa.
That's right. Yeah. So I just thought I'd
yeah.
I just, so that people don't think...
Good job, you've got a memory, haven't it?
I forgot at the time.
Yeah, no, that's it.
So what's your next posting then? You know, you got back, what happens? It's March, isn't it?
Yeah, I get some leave, and I think I had to report... I think I went to HMS Victory. Yes, I went to HMS Victory. I got told to report to HMS Zest, but I had to go to HMS Victory to get me travel warrant and whatever, because it was based in Northern Ireland at Londonderry. And then the next day when I got down. When I got down there, the regulating office said, you go and report to the chief stoker in Frobisher Block, which you normally, and he sent me to work down at the dockyard. Just general cleaning up in the fleet maintenance unit workshops. Well, while I was down there, I could see HMS Zest was tied up alongside the jetty. So in the dinner time, I went back for my lunch in the dinner time. I went over to the regulator office, and I seen this RPO, and I said, excuse me, I said, I'm going to join HMS Zest tomorrow. I said, I was told it was in London, but it's not. It's in the dockyard. Is there any chance of me joining it today to save rail fare and me journeying up to where I now believe I've got to go, Invergordon? I said, because apparently it's sailing tonight for Invergordon. Next morning for Invergordon. So he said, I'll have a word. So he said, come and see me about 3 o'clock. I said, right, you are. So I went back down to the dock and I said, I've got to be up in the barracks by 3 o'clock. Right, and I said, you might as well go up there and stop up there. So I went up and he said, there's no chance. He said, the Master at Arms said, no, you can't go. He said, you've got to stay within the drafting instructions. I said, well, it just seems a waste of time. He said, don't worry about it, lad. He said, you just think. And I went down the dockyard next morning to the same job, and I watched HMS Zest sail out of Portsmouth Harbour. I worked there until lunchtime, and then I had the afternoon off to pack me kit, pack me hammock and all that jazz. And then I had to catch... 4:30 train, I think it was, out of Portsmouth Harbour to London. Went across on the Underground to King's Cross of Euston, not quite sure, where I caught the overnight train at 7:30-ish for Perth. Did we change at Glasgow or Edinburgh? I can't remember. Don't think so. No, we went into Glasgow and we backed in and backed out. Backed in to go straight out across them. Anyway, we got to Perth. We had to go to Perth. Then we travelled overnight all the way up to Perth. Got up there next morning. It was absolutely belting it down with rain. And we had to wait around for the train then to Invergordon. When we got to Invergordon, it was still belting down with rain. There was a lorry there, took us down to the waterfront, the dockyard, for one, because it was quite a big place for the Navy, Invergordon was, and so they'd got their own little workshop there and jetty, and it was also quite a good fishing port.